Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller along with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, here to talk about your insect questions, answer them, and he's more than happy to do that. Here's the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, email talk@wpr.org. Phil, even on this chillier morning, I thought, you know, when I went out to the bird feeders, I thought, well, maybe there won't be quite so many mosquitoes at daybreak. That was a mistake.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have seen these kind of numbers a number of times in my career, although Dr. Stan Temple, who is emeritus professor in wildlife, told me he keeps a trap that he's been correlating insect populations and bird nesting success. And so he has this mosquito trap. He said he caught more mosquitoes recently than he's caught in 30 years.
Wow.
So at least in that one site. And, you know, considering the rainfall patterns we've had since June, it all makes a whole lot of sense. And unless the wind is blowing at least 10 miles an hour or it's about 40 degrees, there will not be any relief. And the rains just keep coming. And so, as I said, I it'll be interesting to see. But every time we get one of these 2 and 3 inches, you can kind of set the clock. It's going to be about 10 days. We get another hatch, and that hatch will last for about 3 to 4 weeks.
We had an email from Bob, and I think let's just get going with that right away because it has to do with the Colorado potato beetle, which a lot of people have had questions about. Last week there were talks, and I said, well, Phil's going to be on pretty soon. He can talk about it. Controlling Colorado potato beetles. Bob's in Cedarburg has planted 3 50-foot rows of potatoes this year. We started controls by hand-picking orange egg masses and depositing and the larvae and adult carcasses in a bucket of soapy water. As the population rebounded, I sprayed with Ortho Bug Be Gone a week later. Let's see, first application worked. 2 or 3 weeks later, though, I had to spray once again to avoid total defoliation. Now I'm harvesting and the tops are dying back. However, the beetle population is high once again. Now appears too late for reductions in yield due to beetles, so I've dropped my controls. What management procedure is effective for a large-scale home gardener?
You got to be aggressive early. I like his understanding of the situation that you take 20% of leaves off a plant, not affect the yield, and we're far enough along now that it's not worth the effort. But when they come crawling out as adults in the spring, everything is kind of on the same calendar. One of the problems we get with second generation is you've got all kinds of different life stages, and they're not all in one place at one time. So even if you got something that works, and that's been the big problem, is that over the years, the old standby insecticides, it used to be 7. Some people use diazinon. I would even be suspicious of the active ingredient in Bug Be Gone not being effective. They're just resistant to it. So usually we talk about the second week of June when the adults are coming on, the eggs are just hatching. That's when you want to really slam the door. And the two groups of products I would look at right now that do work, and at least we've got some things coming down the market. On the organic side, there is an insecticide we know as spinosad. It's sold under the name Entrust, Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew, Monterey's Vegetable and Garden Spray. And spinosad has activity. So that's one product. And it's organic.
Yeah.
The other way is that Bayer is using the same active ingredient. And the commercial people have been using this for quite some time. It has both got a systemic label in particular, so you could put it on at planting or shortly after as a drench. These nicotinoids, though, that we've already started to see some resistance in the field, not so much for home gardens, but commercial people. And so it is a tool that you can use once, but you can't keep going back to the same well. That's kind of it. So once a year is kind of the standard thing. It's interesting, the reaction the beetles we're finding is that the ones that are resistant go into a stupor. You think they're dead, and for about 2 days they just sit there, and be darned, the little stinkers wake up. So they're really not dead. They're just kind of stunned. But, as I said, that product still has a moderate amount of efficacy. So either spinosad or the imidacloprid is the active ingredient would be the two things I would try. I really have very little faith in the other products. One other product you might be able to find, though, is a bacterial insecticide, a BT. The strain is made for killing beetles. In the last market I saw, it was sold under Colorado Potato Beetle Beater. But I, from what I've heard, that's a little hard to find. I can check Gardens Alive, though, because they have traditionally had some of these products under their own label. And again, you got to make sure that the strain you get is a beetle-killing strain and not a caterpillar-killing strain.
Let's turn to Peter in Madison. Peter, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello. What can... the topic is bed bugs.
Okay.
And I have 2 points I want to clear up. One is I need to know the active ingredient that I should look for in order to kill them. And the other is the source. And it was really odd. The tenant came back after being away for a weekend, and the room was infested with them, all coming in from around a window frame. And prior to that, he had no bites, no signs. I never had him in the house. And the only thing I can point to is somebody had thrown away some mattress covers outside the house directly beneath his window. Is it possible for them to migrate in from outside?
Yes, it is. Although,
in numbers.
Yeah, that the one thing, you know, given that scenario, the first thing I would ask you is to get me some bed bugs, because aside from the human bed bug, which is the one that's been driving us crazy, there is a species associated with bats. There's also a species associated with chimney swifts. And when I get these odd, doesn't fit the normal pattern, I'm more suspicious it is another animal host. And they look very similar. It's just the difference of the hairs or segments of antennae. But, of course, the strategy is quite different. So that would be the first thing, is if you can get some specimens, I'd be happy to take a peek at it to sort that through. The active ingredient one's a curious question because, to be honest, I'm not so sure I have faith, total faith, in any chemicals right now. The commercial people have been using heat treatments because the chemicals aren't working near as well. And the resistance factor is up to about 2,500-fold for the standard pyrethroid insecticides, which make up about 90% of what people are using.
Uh-huh.
So it's really gotten tough, and that would be, if we had a chemical that would work, this would clean up, I think, quite easily. But because these chemicals aren't working, that's why we're in so deep into problems. So, but as I said, I think the first step, let's make sure we got the right one, because that will, if it is the species associated with bats, then almost any chemical will work. They're not resistant to anything.
Mm.
But you'd spray in a different area. It would also suggest that you might have a bat issue in the structure that needs to be dealt with, so.
Well, I stopped in to see you the Friday before you left on vacation. Hopefully this time I'll be able to catch you.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Peter, for calling. Appreciate it. Charlie in Minnesota, southeast Minnesota. Hello.
Hi, Larry. Question for Phil. I have a stand of about 15 acres, including hickory trees. There is an insect, a large wasp-like creature with an emerald abdomen, that is laying eggs and killing my hickory trees. They attack the tree about halfway up. The tree gets sick, and it eventually tips over right in the middle. And I'm hoping Phil can tell me what these things are.
Well, to be honest, I think the critters are secondary, and they're because something else is going on, because it sounds like it's a horntail of some sort. And horntails only want to lay their eggs in dead and dying tissue.
Okay.
And so I think we got to take a step back. There is a little bark beetle that I've seen on hickory, although traditionally that's been associated with droughts and high stress, and it's definitely not been droughty, so I wouldn't expect that. Disease-wise, I know that there's some things that have been popping up, but I just don't think of any disease comes to mind right away saying, oh, that's got to be what's killing hickory. But I think it takes some more investigation here. There's something going on that's weakening the trees to the point. So they said the horntails are a sign that the trees are really in trouble.
It's called the horntail, and they end up with very large pupa that comes out when you cut the wood up for firewood.
Yeah. In fact, I often associate them as firewood insects because they're attacking dead and dying trees. Those are the ones you cut. And then, of course, when people bring those in the house, we get all kinds of interesting insects come crawling out. But as I said, there's the only aggressive insect that I would normally associate with killing hickory is the little bark beetles. And again, I have only really seen those after successive significant droughts in of anything. As I said, the trees should be growing very well. This has been a good year for trees because of the high moisture levels.
Okay, thanks for your answer.
All right, thank you for calling. Phil in Hebron, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, you guys. Let's talk about our good friend, the mosquito.
Okay.
I grow woody plants. I propagate fill in large plastic-covered greenhouses that are basically a sealed system. Nice high temperatures, high 90s, nice high humidity. And, of course, I raise a wonderful crop of mosquitoes in that environment. And this year is as good as any year. I usually have extremely good luck and just knocking the population down because I have a sealed structure that I can circulate the fog in there and knock them down to nothing. But the only thing that will go in there once in a while, swallows will go in there and have a little buffet. My question is, this year, and then when I get warm years like this, I find a tremendous rebound at about 6 days. Is that about right for a hatch, or are they coming in from the outside to my happy environment?
I think they're coming in from outside, because I can't believe you've got enough standing water for a long enough time to get the breeding. I mean, if it did, is when you'd have a little puddle and you hit it, you'd see these, they call the larvae wigglers, and that's what they do. They just wiggle like a snake on speed. I mean, it's just a zip, and if I think you would see that, and without seeing that, as I said, and considering now, and particularly because the environment is so saturated with them, I can see where they'd be highly attracted to the high humidity and the lushness of the houses. But they're sneaking in somewhere from outside.
Yeah,
are you drawing?
My environment's a wet pea gravel, but there's no water, and I thought, even if they're flood water, I don't really have standing water to speak of. I mean, 100% humidity, but no really standing water, so I think they're just moving in because they like what I've created.
Yeah, yeah. And are you drawing air in then for ventilating those houses?
No, actually, I'm going so energy efficient, it's ridiculous. We basically don't enter the houses except in spring and then fall of the year, so they can go to 110 and hold humidity to the point that you just walk in your wet dish rag. So no, I really don't do any ventilating of any sort. There's no new requirements, so I don't use the energy.
Okay. Uh-huh. But then again, there's no question. There's just no way I think you have the water, so they're coming in. But
So there you have it, Phil. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate
your call. The only other thing that gets a little tough is that because most of our insecticides are pyrethroids now, pyrethroids by nature tend to get weak when things get real warm. And so I would suggest one thing, when you do apply things, it's probably better on the cooler parts, you know, very early morning or, you know, late after sunset. Because if you're doing it in the middle of the day, I would think that the chemical is breaking down extremely quickly.
Somebody else wondered if there's an organic or non-toxic treatment that could be applied to a garden to reduce the number of mosquitoes.
Well, they sell things like garlic oil that will kill them on contact, but you really wonder how much, you know, much like the story this gentleman has, is if you could magically snap your fingers and kill all the mosquitoes in your yard, it depending on the conditions, it takes minutes to hours for them to recolonize, and that's the problem. But, you know, pyrethrum itself is an organic product, very broad label, good knockdown, you know, and is used in some of the older foggers, although I think most of the chemicals we see now are synthetic versions of pyrethrum. And just for that matter, they're quick knockdown, no residual, which environmentally is a better way to do things.
Sure.
You don't upset things. But again, realize that there are limitations to how long this is going to be effective.
Greg in Green Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Greg.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Good. my wife and I were picking tomatoes yesterday, and we've got an amazing growth this year. So we've harvested a lot of them, but we're noticing some holes in them, and I've got the bug wrong, but I think it's an earwig, a little black bug with a little pinchers at the front. And I'm wondering, is it too late to treat for those at all?
Well, a couple things. Earwigs have pincers on the back, not the front, and they get to be about an inch long or under an inch.
Then it's not earwig, but it's just a little black bug with pinchers on the front.
Well, one of the things I'm suspicious of, you might have picnic beetles, which is a little black bug that has a couple little kind of orange dots. And the thing about picnic beetles is they show up after somebody else has done something. They get into overly ripe fruit that has bruised spots. They like to get into places where slugs have been feeding, and they'll gouge out something, and then these things will root around. And so I think it might be worth it. Does it seem to be more the fruit that's on the ground, or is it fruit that's anywhere on the plant?
It's both. Mm-hmm. Definitely fruit that's on the tomatoes that were on the vine, you know.
Mm. Well, you know, the first critter at this late in the game, there is a little green caterpillar called the tomato fruit worm, and that would potentially start the holes. But as I said, I'm suspicious you might have picnic beetles, which are secondary, and I think you really, we got to do a little more detective work to figure out who exactly is the culprit here.
Okay.
And then once we know that, you know, then we can probably direct you in a direction of to control things. But without knowing it, it feels like shooting in the dark.
Yeah. So send some samples or what?
Well, you know, it'd be worth going out at night with a flashlight and, you know, put some clothes on so the mosquitoes don't get you. But I think, you know, look underneath things to see if you can find something, see if there's any foliage disappearing. I mean, those all would be things I would look at. And again,
yeah, no foliage.
Okay.
All I've noticed is on the tomatoes are small, pretty round holes in them, and, you know, and looks
oh
like
boy.
They've dug in.
Round holes sound like fruit worms. And I'm okay. wondering when these tomatoes, and you know, some that are so dinged up, you're probably not bringing inside, but you're going to find a green worm that gets up to be about 2 inches long and about the diameter of a pencil.
Okay.
Those would respond to almost any garden insecticide. They're really not hard to kill. And they're not an annual problem in the state. The species of moth that causes those caterpillars, sometimes it blows up here and sometimes it doesn't. But if we have it, it's always kind of a late summer problem. It never gets going yeah. early.
All right.
And what would you put on them then, if that was the case?
Everything from the bacterial products, BT, Malathion, 7, Bug Be Gone, which is usually bifenthrin, permethrin, all those products would work.
And they're safe for consumption.
Yeah, the only thing you got to do, and this really, even whether products are organic or not, is that it's got to be labeled for vegetables, so it's got to say tomato there. And the other thing you'll see on there is there will be a harvest restriction. For some things, it's 1 day. For some things, it's 10 days. And if you're okay. talking about safety, you just have to follow the rules. And, of course, when things yeah. are ripe right now, you don't want something with a long residual. You want something with a short residual.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest today. Jim Packard, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in with your insect question at 1-800-642-1234. Winnie and Krivitz up next. Winnie, hello. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. I have a question about fruit flies.
Okay.
Are they... is it especially bad this year? Because it seems like in the past, fruit flies would start bothering you in, like right now, in August, and then go until the first frost. But it's been weeks and weeks, and we've had lots of fruit flies that have just been a terrible nuisance in the kitchen. And keeping it clean and keeping the compost covered and out in the garage has helped tremendously, but I was just wondering if this is an unusual year for them, or have you heard anything from people?
Well, when somebody has a reoccurring fruit fly problem like you have for an extended period of time, most fruit fly problems have nothing to do with what's going on outside.
You know, uh-huh.
It's a localized problem. And the thing about fruit flies and how they breed is that their little tiny maggots feed on the yeast that we associate with overly ripe whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so usually there's a source, and in this case, it sounds like a source that's getting renewed. And so, you know, the compost pile could be the problem. But, you know, what I look for in those cases is the little white maggots present. The other thing you often see if you get into a hot spot is that the maggots often will crawl just a little distance away from the food product and pupate. So there's little casings around. Mm. And so to me, it's like finding smoke. That's exactly where the problem is, and that's what needs to be cleaned up. What gets tricky, though, is that, you know, people sometimes have a devil of a time identifying the site. You know, a little later on, most of my fruit fly complaints come in later in the season. And it can be September through into November. And so I start worrying about pumpkins that are in the basement that have got a bad soft spot. Or, you know, I do see them on recycled cans. It's just the syrup and stuff that's in there as that ferments they can come from. It's usually not the stuff that you have in the kitchen. Even though the flies are attracted to the bananas are not rotten enough yet to be a breeding site.
Yeah.
They're an attractant site. So as I said, you kind of take it back and see where can... They need moisture. There's no way if whatever they're on, like if I took raisins and put them out in the middle of a kitchen, that would not breed fruit flies. But if I added water to it and this started to ferment and the like, then all of a sudden they're off and running. So it's a source of organic matter where the yeast would be associated with the breakdown of something and moisture. And once you find it and clean it up, things should improve big time. In fact, you should be done with it.
Oh, huh. Well, that's interesting. Well, we had I have a little bit of a solution. My daughter was visiting us, and we were cooking dinner one evening, and she was having a margarita, and she sort of didn't keep at it at all. And all of a sudden, we looked over, and here were the fruit flies were just hovering around and drowning in this margarita. And so I just kept it out. We just left it out, and that seems to have controlled it tremendously. I don't have very many fruit flies flying around now.
Oh, it'll be a great adult trap, but the point with that is you're not getting at the source yet, and so I expect it to continue. But
that's
again,
interesting. I don't know where to look for the source, really, because they do hover around the bananas, and I haven't put any garbage at all in the trash, so that's no longer a place. And
you're going to have to do a little more detective work.
I've even seen them in rags that were used to clean up things like orange juice and weren't rinsed out, and they might be sitting in a corner somewhere that can ferment enough. I've seen them underneath the defrost pan in a freezer. Again, if that gets kind of slimy and goopy, I've seen them breed from that site. I think the main thing is be careful not to just think it's in the kitchen, because it could be in the basement, and yet the fruit flies then kind of filter up and get into your living space. So I expect them to show up in the kitchen no matter where the breeding site is. The other thing is we even see old bulbs when people bring in bulbs that are rotten, they don't know about. I can breed fruit flies out of, gladiola corms, those kind of things that are soft.
Good luck. Winnie, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Barb and McGuanigo, you are next. Hi, Barb.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, so this morning I found a rat that the barn cat brought in out on the patio, and I went to scoop it up with a shovel, and it had a big hole in its chest, and this nasty worm type thing came out, and I went online and looked it up, and it was a bot fly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just wondering, do I have to worry about now my dogs and cats getting infected, or how about even humans?
No, there is a human bot fly if you go down to Mexico, but most bot flies are very host specific, and you're seeing the end of the life stage in the maggot form, and what it's supposed to do is burrow in the ground, and then I would assume next year, now it's late enough, would transform into the adult bot fly that's got to go find another rat, or there's one associated with rabbits, there's one associated with chipmunks, but they're host specific enough, but boy, they're big enough and ugly enough looking, it scares the living dickens out of folks, but definitely nothing to worry about. There have been a few cases I'm aware of cases where the adult fly has laid its egg and shown up in a cat or something, and it turns out to be the chipmunk species, but that's pretty rare, and this has nothing to do with the phenomena that you've seen. So it's kind of a weird, interesting thing to look at, but definitely nothing to worry about.
Great. And is it common? Do we have to worry about, lots of these things around?
You never get overrun with them, but typically I think more often it's people who have cats where the cats brought a little, rodent present home is where people find them.
Yeah.
Now, if we were to catch the rodent when it was still active, it would look like a tumor on the back or some part of it.
Hmm.
And then, and that really what happens with the human bot fly, too. You get this growth that looks like a tumor, but there's a little hole cut in the top of the skin because the maggot has to breed. Or breathe, and then eventually, of course, they come squeezing out or people squeeze them out. But again, if you look up human bot fly, the intriguing thing to me is that the fly does not lay its egg on people. The fly lays its egg on a mosquito. And when the mosquito bites you, the egg hatches and they burrow in. Talk about an amazing type of evolution. I mean, to me, I'm just always mind-boggled to think about how that evolved.
There's it's really gross videos and pictures on the internet. And I was really getting worried.
Understandably.
No, and it's interesting. Growing up in Wisconsin and I never would have thought I would see cases of human bot fly here. And I've seen a number of in my career. But, of course, as people are traveling around, it's somebody that's been to Mexico, Central America, so it all makes sense. But usually what happens is, they go to the doctor, they find the larvae, they send it in to us to take a peek at, and, we can talk about their travel history. I've never run into a case where it's been acquired in the States because we just don't have the fly here.
All right.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Barb. Jim in Waupun, your turn. Hold on a second there, Jim. I'll do a little thing here. All right. Let's see if we got Jim now. Jim, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I have two beautiful purple autumn ashes in my backyard, and I also have a high hedge all around the perimeter. And every other year, I buy about 70 bags of wood mulch, and I mulch the high hedge and the base of the trees. My first question is, could I be bringing the emerald ash borer in by using that mulch? That's one question.
No.
Second question is, these two ash trees are fairly isolated. There are no other ash trees within several blocks, and the other trees are a half mile away at a county park. Is there a chance that I might escape the emerald ash borer in the future? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Well, the first question on wood chips, you know, the chips that they use are small enough, dry out quick enough and whatnot that is not normally considered a source. Even if it came from an infested ash, they, you know, it's just not an environment that the larvae can live long enough to be able to transform into the adults. You're at a definite advantage having isolated trees, but the beetle is a relatively strong flyer. I've been very pleasantly surprised. Last year I was depressed, but this year I've been surprised because although we have found a couple within known county infestations, I was expecting to see more positive counties and more hotspots show up. And so that's been somewhat encouraging. And of course, you know, we are talking about only treating trees if you are really in a county that's infested or extremely close by. And so, you know, for like a case like Dane County, where we don't have anything really close to us, we're not recommending people treat for emerald ash borer. And part of what you got to keep in mind here is when the insect does show up, it takes it usually 3 or 4 years to really kill a tree. And the chemicals that are out there are curative. You can take a tree that's infested and cure it. And so I think people have a lot of time to react. So we hate to see people spend a lot of time and money and put insecticide where it doesn't do any good. And so, as I said, I think it's been encouraging in the short run this year of not seeing anything other than some pockets in Milwaukee County in particular, and up in Ozaukee County, too. They found a little bit of activity outside the core area, but things have been stayed pretty localized. And even some of the hot spots from last year, like Green Bay, they found one beetle up there last year. They've, as far as I've seen so far this year, have found none.
Mary, thanks again for calling, Jim. Appreciate it. Mary in, I'm not sure where she's from, Duluth, Minnesota. Recently took off old cedar siding on a house built in 1975. Thousands of tiny pencil tip size moths flying around the house now. Seem to land on screens at night. Will these moth-like bugs disappear, or should I have the pests sprayed before having the vinyl siding completed?
They should disappear. I'm not exactly sure who it is. This would be a case I'd be happy to take a peek at it if you want to send a specimen down the lab. There is a group of moths associated with poplar trees and their leaves that they overwinter as adults, and they sometimes cause this kind of problem. Seems a bit early for that. The other thing is that I have been getting, for at least the last 3 to 4 weeks, a number of samples and calls about a little, we call it a pyralid moth. In fact, the critter's called a celery leaf tire. I've never seen this in my career, and people are just reporting just hundreds of them just all over the shrubbery and whatnot. And, of course, anytime you see a number of insects, it gets your attention. But they're harmless from what we can tell, and especially the adults. So I have a suspicion that you had some critters that were probably looking for shelter to probably spend the winter already. I mean, insects do get that way, and that's the phenomena you've seen. If it doesn't clear up in a week or so, then that's when I think it'd be worth sending me either a good picture one or a specimen, and let's just make sure we're talking about the same thing. Because usually when I hear about moths in the house, it's more things coming out of the bird seed and whatnot, and not things that are hiding underneath the siding.
Let's go to Jennifer in Appleton next. Hi, Jen.
Hi. My question is back to the mosquitoes. I was wondering whether or not some people are more tasty to mosquitoes than others, and if they are, why is that?
Oh, boy, I tell you, my wife and daughter always want me along when we go on a walk because I draw the mosquitoes.
It's
interesting. There's a group of USDA researchers down in Florida, and what they do is they put a person in this little booth, and they collect all the gases and everything that come off and try to see what things. And it's a whole succession of things. We do know that carbon dioxide is at the top of the list. That's the most attracting thing to mosquitoes. Acetone and lactic acid, which are byproducts that are on our skin. And then other things come into play. But the interesting thing they will tell you is they've got this whole list of concoctions of that, you know, what attracts mosquitoes, and they can put it together chemically, and you can put a person in the room, and there are some people that can outcompete their concoction every time. And so we know there's even more points to it. And one of the things that gets a little tough with this, too, is that in Wisconsin we have 54 different kinds of mosquitoes, and not all mosquitoes react the same to all people. And so there's this added complexity here, but they're definitely, you know, We will tell you that the more active you are, the more carbon dioxide you generate, the more attractive you should be, which normally would suggest men are more attractive than women because we have more body mass. But it does get more complicated than that. And then the other side of it is that we also differ in how we react to them. And some people, you know, the bites hardly cause any nuisance, and so I don't think they really realize how many bites they get, whereas other people will get bites that take a week or more to go away and those kind of complications. But it is a proven fact. I think everybody has seen it, that there is just some people that no matter what can outcompete anything we can come up with. And as I said, it's got to do with body chemistry, but even though we've studied it, I don't think we've got all the answers here yet.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jennifer, for calling. Dwight and Judy emailed us, for the past 4 years, from July through August, we've been fighting back an unending hatch of millipedes. What's the best way to fight them other than surrender?
Well, I can be comical here and say if you make all your area around you a giant parking lot, the problem with millipedes, they live in the soil and they feed on organic matter. And typically I don't worry about lawns because lawn is kind of a desert. There isn't that much going on. But you must have a beautiful home out in the country, and either you have a long grass prairie next to you or you have a wooded area that's got a lot of decaying leaves. All those kind of things are the things that would fuel the populations. And then what happens most often is at night that sometimes the millipedes go through a migratory phase. So they're just out crawling around. When the sun comes up, they accumulate where it's cool, damp, and dry. So cool, damp, and moist. So you will see them accumulate on a cement slab in the garage or maybe on the north side of the house. And so you treat and you kill all those millipedes, but you haven't got at the source.
Right.
And so that's what I'm wondering is if you can identify where the source is. And you will never eliminate them unless the environment changes dramatically in the areas around you. And so, as I said, what we find in developments is more houses get built and whatnot, you tend to get more traditional lawns and there's no big source of organic matter. And so millipedes kind of go away. But if you're out in an area where there is a lot of organic matter and the like, it will be somewhat a constant problem. But what I would suggest is if you can identify if it's the south side of your property that's the source, you're going to be more effective at treating that area between where your lawn stops and where this stuff starts, so you can kind of head them off at the pass. Just spraying primarily around your foundation and whatnot, you've already allowed the millipedes to migrate all the way to your house. And as I said, I think you'll at least have better success in controlling them out on the margins of areas rather than allowing the millipedes to migrate in.
Barbara in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I've been trying to grow hollyhocks, and they seem to be attacked by a really small, it looks like a black fly with like a little red dot on its head. I tried spraying with organic spray. It would knock them down, but within like a day, they would be back. And they eat the leaves, and they actually look like lace by the time they get through eating all of the leaves. Any suggestions?
Well, I'm not totally convinced the critter you're seeing is the culprit.
Okay.
I will tell you, on hollyhocks, the thing that I see that lace the leaves up is a little green worm. And it's small, and it's on the undersides of the leaves. And because of that, most people miss it. And you know, it is a sawfly, which means it looks like a caterpillar, but it grows up to be something different than a moth or a butterfly. Soapy water, honestly, or the insecticidal soaps would have some efficacy. And there are other types of treatments. But what you have to look for is when the first little nicks show up, you treat. And in this case, you want to treat on the undersides of leaves, which is a bother, but that's where the critters are. I don't know if you've got aphids. There are some plant bugs I've seen that cause a little bit of spotting on the leaves, but I, when it starts to get big leaves that are all laced up, as I said, I think of something chewing, and I don't normally expect that either out of flies or aphids because just the way they feed.
Mm. Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Barbara. Terry in Wanakee, your turn. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen. Just a quick comment as opposed to a question. Sadly, my wife and I found caterpillars on some of our plants and innocently bagged them and took them in for identification. The next day we found out they were monarchs, and so I just wanted to alert people, if they see caterpillars that are green, black, and white, they look really ugly, they turn into beauty, and I'll let you respond. I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right, thanks for calling.
One of the things I've always found fascinating is when people send me caterpillars, and I tell them to grow up to be a butterfly, everybody's warm and soft and fuzzy. If they're going to grow up to be an ugly moth, they want to kill it. And, you know, ultimately, there isn't biologically that much difference. But monarch caterpillars would be on milkweeds. That's the only thing they can feed on. A caterpillar looks somewhat similar. You'll find on parsley right now is the caterpillar stage of the black swallowtail butterfly. One that I've been getting, and this has been a much better butterfly year than last year. I mean, last year, they really were non-existent. But I've had a number of people email me pictures of a big green caterpillar that has two big eye spots, very big eye spots up towards the head. That is the larval stage of the tiger swallowtail. And you can find that on your apple trees. You could find them on your poplar trees and a few other things. And I think it's good for people to sit back and take a look. And, you know, now with the internet, there's a lot more aids in helping identify things. But I think what frustrates people, I mean, we've got 2,000 species of moths in the state. Yeah. And so I got 2,000 little caterpillars that, you know, so sometimes it's a little hard. But the butterflies in particular, most of those I think are you can find images pretty easy. And, you know, the old adage, just because it's a bug, it doesn't deserve to die. And I think it's worth sitting back and making sure what you got before you take any drastic measures.
Ken from De Pere has a question about earwigs. What's the proper time to control populations of earwigs? What can be done in the spring, now, or in the fall? They are every place I look.
Okay. Basically, earwigs, it's too late to do much that's going to be very effective right now. Honestly, I see their populations start to decline by the 1st of August. What I tend to find is in the Madison area about Memorial Day is when the earwigs come out of the ground as half-grown earwigs. And so that's when you want to shut the doors, the first week or two of June, and spray the wet mulched areas where they are hiding and feeding. And then I think you'll be much more satisfied. Over time, they'll tend to disperse out of there and show up in the house and all kinds of other places. You know, you've heard me say before that they don't go in your ears. I have had 5 cases this year of people who have had to have them dealt with in one form or another, going to see the doctor. In one case, they even perforated the eardrum. That's not their normal nature, but there's just so many of them out there. The other thing that's interesting is in the Madison area and whatnot, where they have been for 2 or 3 decades, they're out there and they love it lush, but they're not crazy. Where I'm getting the biggest complaints is the far northwestern part of the state, where they're relatively new.
Oh.
And that's a common pattern I have found in my career, that when new things show up, they are the worst, and over time they get much better. But if you got to get your defenses up, as I said, it's all about watching things. If it's a very dry spring, they probably won't be there. But if it's a lush spring around the first week of June, that's when you want to slam the door.
A listener from Appleton says, I have a question about tiny insects that resemble flies that are on perennials. They come at you like a cloud when you touch or come near the plant.
Where are they located?
Appleton.
Yeah, a little suspicious they're lake flies, but it could be somebody else. You know, the famous Lake Winnebago lake fly. Lake flies are related to mosquitoes. Again, they're literally well over 100 species, but they're little gnat-like creatures, and they go through this phenomenon where the males get into clouds that we call swarms. And these swarms are often associated with something in the landscape. They might be 2 feet above your garbage can, and you see these little clouds, or they might be above plants. And really what happens is these swarms are the insect equivalent of a dating bar, because the females will come in and select a male out of there. And, you know, if it's real windy one day, it's real cloudy, they're probably not active, but you'll often see them certain times. And I really wonder if that's what it is this is a gnat swarm of some sort or another. And when they bump them, you know, the things are kind of flying all over and they kind of settle out pretty quick. The interesting thing, they're very short lived and they can't bite. In fact, they don't even feed in the adult stage if it's truly one of these lake flies.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil, we have Jackie from Milwaukee online with a question for you, so let's go to Jackie.
Hi. And you for putting me on. I've got another something to add. When you talk about the butterflies and everything like that, people put out a lot of butterfly bushes and everything. That's great for the butterflies to come and get the nectar. But you have to have things like the milkweed pods where they can lay their eggs so they will eventually hatch.
Right.
Yeah, you basically, you know, if you're interested in particular butterflies, you got to find out the plant they like to feed on and have it there so there's something for their caterpillars. And
the other comment is, if the lady ever keeps potatoes, I buy more than I should because it's only me now, and I had a place, one of my cabinets, one of my dogs went over and sniffed. In the middle of a bag of potatoes was one that had committed suicide.
Yeah.
And that also could have those little flies in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Definitely. That's a good one. Onions, too. Another one. You got bad onions. It's organic matter. It's moist. And, oh, boy, I can breed. I can't.
It'd be an interesting
experiment, but you can, I'm sure, breed thousands of fruit flies from one good-sized potato.
Thanks, Jackie.
Hi.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Sandra has a question about purple martins as mosquito killers. She's heard that they're really good for controlling mosquitoes. Everything I've heard is that that's not the case.
Yeah, I think they get more press than they deserve. Dragonflies are far more efficient. I mean, martins do pick up some mosquitoes, but typical of birds and bats, they're looking for bigger meals. And so they're feeding on larger insects than mosquitoes. The other thing is that, you know, a lot of the mosquito activities at night when the birds aren't flying anyway. Bats are better, but dragonflies outdo them big time. You know, funny thing, I got a good friend at the archery club I belong to. He sent me an email. He said he had seen a couple clouds of mosquitoes and the bats flew in there and they were never seen again. And that's another measurement of how bad they are this year, I think.
And dragonflies, there've been a lot of reports on these really giant dragonflies, or at least that's what people are calling them.
Well, you know, the biggest dragonfly we have is the green darner, Anax junius. And this is a good year for dragonflies. And it's not just the mosquitoes. A lot of these are pond breeders. And with all this moisture, we got more ponds than normal. The other thing is that the added heat is getting them to develop quicker. And then there's certain times that we get swarms of dragonflies. And to be honest, it's kind of an unknown reason why they swarm like this. I've heard this discussion between a number of entomologists, and I don't think we really understand, but you'll get cases where, even though dragonflies are often very territorial and whatnot, that you'll get large numbers showing up in an area. You usually figure there's a lot of food. And so, again, if we got ants swarming or other things, that might attract them in. But that does catch people's attention. And in particular, I know there's been a couple articles in the Milwaukee papers recently about dragonflies and the like. And, you know, we have almost 80 species of dragonflies in the state.
Wow.
Which is kind of neat. And
yeah.
As I said, I much better catch a mosquito. So they are our friends. Nothing wrong with the purple martins, but definitely the dragonflies, I think, are more efficient at taking care of those little critters.
Diane wonders if you could discuss the somewhat new mosquito repellent and alternative to DEET, and I'm not sure about the pronunciation, picaridin?
Yeah, that's a product that's been used in Europe for well over, I think, about 20 years, and it's got a relatively recent registration in the United States. Similar to DEET as far as how long it lasts, and of course there's also eucalyptus oil and some other variations of that out there. So I think in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been a lot of alternatives if people aren't comfortable with DEET that can be used. And, you know, things like eucalyptus oil, there's even a soybean oil product called Bite Blocker that has, you know, in the short run, really some pretty good mosquito repellent activity. And so the thing is, you know, just pay attention when you go to buy the stuff and what the active ingredients are. And as I said, if you're not comfortable with DEET, there's definitely a lot of alternatives that are good. There's a few other things out there, though, that you get a little cautious of. You know, some of these, you know, magic plants that are supposed to repel mosquitoes and whatnot, there's just no science to support that. One other one that I've seen recently is a little a product that you put on your skin, and it's supposed to go and become systemic. And, boy, that caught my attention real quick.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out it's vitamin B1, which is known to have some repellency, but the reality is it's relatively weak. And so the way I explain it to people is instead of getting 10 bites, you get 8 bites. So, you know, life is better than it would be, but I think people's expectations are something like that it will totally repel the mosquitoes and they're not going to bite me, and it doesn't work that way.
Sylvia in Appleton, we turn to you now. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. I have three quick comments. A week ago, we were fortunate enough over in Marquette County to see flocks of the alfalfa clouded sulfur butterflies, thousands and thousands of them over a field. It was just fantastic. And this past Saturday, we got to see the green darners over in Green Lake County just swarming along with a nice little flock of nighthawks above them. But we've never seen them that prolific. And about 6-7 years ago, my cat was parasitized by a botfly. And luckily, we caught it early because it was by his eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two questions. I have, the last 2 years, gotten some what I call super bees in my garden. especially on my Monarda, the red Monarda. They are absolutely huge, and I know there's like four or five, you know, good-sized bees out there all the time, but these were humongous. Is this a new strain? I've never seen them before.
I wouldn't think so. What I'm guessing is a bumblebee of some sort, and
yes,
we do have
is.
Some very large bumblebees. In fact, we've had 18 species recorded in the state historically.
Okay.
And even within a bumblebee colony, you will have differences in sizes. So I just think you might have a species that's bigger than the norm active, but off the top of my head, I'm just not familiar enough with the species to know what it has to be. But I don't think it's new. I think it's just, again, you're lucky enough to be in an area where you have one of these native species that is doing well, which, you know, interesting. We've talked before on the show about the problems with honeybees. Bumblebees have been showing some problems throughout the United States that we associate with some disease problems that have been brought in. So unfortunately, they're having a tough time. Not all the species. The other thing is bumblebees have definitely suffered because of environmental changes. You know, a lot of these prairie species and whatnot, of course, as that land has been destroyed, don't have near as much habitat. So, you know, one of the biggest areas of entomology right now is the interest in native pollinators. And, you know, we have literally hundreds of little tiny bees other than bumblebees and honeybees that are we're trying to understand better, because these things can help us out with pollinating our crops, too.
Yes, I have. And I'm not afraid of them. I go out there and I hit the bushes by mistake, mowing the grass and stuff. And I've never had a problem with being attacked or even, you know, being afraid of all those bumblebees out there, considering what the yellow jackets are like. And the other question I have is, I have monarch eggs on my milkweed, and they disappear. I also have a lot of earwigs, and I'm wondering, is it possible that earwigs are eating the eggs?
Eggs or even small larvae. Earwigs are scavengers, and they definitely have been documented to cause problems. Even Asian lady beetles have been documented to cause problems with it, and so... You know, this is a case, I don't know if you want to go through the bother, but if you want to get a higher success rate when you get eggs or small larvae, it's almost worth putting in the house and in growing them under a sheltered, contained situation rather than just leaving them out.
I have done that, but it's labor-intensive to keep fresh stuff in there. And but I was wondering if it's the earwigs that were doing this, because you go one day, there's eggs, and the next day the earwigs are up in the little top part of it, and then the eggs are gone.
Yeah, no, I think you hit it right on the head that there's a very good chance that they've been feeding on them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Allison in Racine, we turn to you. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering about controlling Japanese beetles. They're all over my rose bushes, and I was looking in the Good Bug, Bad Book, Bad Bug book, and it said to physically remove them and put them in soapy water. Would spraying a soapy water solution on the roses help, or?
No, only because the soap, if it gets into their body, will kill them, but they're too thick skin for a spray to be effective.
Okay.
What the research data tells us is when you handpick them like that, you do reduce the population on your plants by 50%, so you're gaining on them. But I think the biggest frustration for Japanese beetles for most of us is that because they're flying in from down the road, it's a constant two-month battle. I will tell you at least... And we've talked again about this on the show, is that in areas where Japanese beetle has been established for the longest time, their populations have been in major decline. And again, in Madison, it's amazed me. The last 3 years in particular, each year we've had at least a 50% reduction in the population. Oh. And so it's went from, I have a colleague over in the soil science department, Dr. Phil Barak, who keeps traps and he weighs the traps. And so he's got data from his backyard. You know, and he was catching, you know, 15,000 beetles, you know, 4 years ago. He hasn't even caught 2,000 beetles this year. You know, it's just been this. And we honestly believe that there is some natural balance going on here. Many people speculate it's a protozoan disease that is moving in the population. So in the long run, I think there's hope to see this settle down. But it may take 5 or 6 years. I mean, it definitely doesn't happen overnight. And that's the unfortunate thing. So if you've got plants... you know, it's a battle, and no matter what spray you choose, even if it's, you know, you're organic, not organic, the frustration is the sprays only last for a few days, and the beetles, again, are active for a couple months straight. So it means, you know, labor-intensive, lots of activity to try to fight the fight.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Allison. And Ron in Madison, hi to you.
Good morning, gentlemen. I appreciate you answering my questions. On TV lately, we've been advertising this off. It's in like a fan that you wear that's supposed to repel flies and mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the comments I've heard are very, very positive. And I've tried it, and it seems to work for me.
Oh, no, that product, because it has some insecticide in it. And so you've got this small cloud of insecticide that has some repellency and some knockdown. There's another version of that that maybe is a little bit of an upgrade as far as how it works. There's a product line called Thermacell, which is a similar thing. The difference is how the chemical works. They have a little hot coil. They have, a little butene thing that you put the pad on. And what that causes the insecticide is to disperse a little bit better than it does the little off things. But they both work. And, you know, it's an alternative to putting things on your skin. But it still, again, has some insecticidal activity, so you have to realize that.
Yeah.
I have another question, and that is about using the old yellow Listerine, the old stuff.
For what?
You're supposed to spray that on your skin, and that's supposed to help keep mosquitoes and flies away?
Listerine as a repellent. We will ponder that. And Phil will be back with an educated response in just a couple of minutes here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking insects here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Lots of callers online and lots of email questions. Let's go online. Well, before we do that, Ron in Madison asked us,
what about the Listerine?
Listerine. Would you put Listerine on your arms as a repellent?
Well, I think just even the alcohol drying your skin might be something you have to take in consideration. And from what I've seen, it's not that good a repellent. So I think there are far better choices that are out there. And you know, people, you got to be careful with home remedies because a lot of time these things have not been scientifically tested. And in some cases, honestly, the effect is exact opposite of what people think.
Kathy in Plover, on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you. I have another question about the black swallowtail caterpillar.
Mm-hmm.
I have a pretty good-sized parsley plant in my garden, and I noticed some weeks ago that it was just loaded with little caterpillars of various sizes and various colors they were growing. And I looked them up to see what they were, you know, identified them as a black swallowtail caterpillar, and I got all excited about that, so I thought they can have the plants. There's plenty there for me later on. I know I'll just replant it. So I watched them over a couple of weeks, and they kept growing and growing, and as I said, there were different sizes. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like the smaller ones started to disappear. So I thought, well, I've got a lot of birds in my yard, and I assumed that the birds were taking them. And I didn't want that to happen because some of them were really, really large. And I still had, I probably started out with better than two dozen, you know, three dozen maybe, just loaded. So I took a piece of chicken wire and I made a dome over the plant because I wanted to protect them. You know, I thought I could maybe keep the birds out. And then I didn't check the plant for a couple of days. And I went back out there to look and they were all gone, every single one, even the big... The biggest ones were probably 2 inches long, 2.5 inches long, something like
yeah.
that. Pretty things. But they were all gone. And I was wondering if there's something else that takes them, maybe chipmunks or toads or snakes or anything else.
Toads would definitely feed on them. But one of the phenomena you might have seen is when caterpillars are close to being transforming into butterflies, they migrate away from their food source.
Okay, yeah.
And so they'll make the chrysalis, you know, it might even be quite a few feet away. And so the bigger ones, I think, just went cruising and looking for places to pupate. Middle-sized ones would make me nervous something came in to eat them, but it's, you know, so many things eat them. And they get their own parasites, they get diseases. You know, that's one of the trouble when you get insects concentrated like that in a small area. We often get virus diseases and other things that cause epidemics, and we lose them that way.
Wouldn't I have found them dead on the ground or something like that?
Well, the virus thing, really, it's very quick, to be honest, from the time they get sick and start getting off color till turning in just to a liquid sack of tissue is a matter of hours sometimes.
Oh, really? Okay, when they do go off to spin their chrysalis, where do they go?
Usually sheltered places. I mean, I often find them kind of underneath leaf litter or sticks or twigs.
Okay.
You know, and then of course they have to worry about mice and other things too. I mean, yeah. in the like, but they're very well camouflaged, and so they're often pretty hard to see. And you know, I'm guessing we're getting late enough now, if it's still going on, that it'll probably maintain in the pupal stage until next spring and emerge. It's getting, you know, the day length's getting short. The insects already know the winter are coming, and I'm not so sure they could push another generation or not. It just kind of depends how warm some will try. I mean, that's the interesting thing is, you know, you see an insect's got 2 generations a year. Well, sometimes it's 2.5. You know, if it's a warm season like this year, we have initial growing season. It gives the insects a chance, and if they're lucky enough, fine, they're successful. If not, there's some that are already in a life stage that will get them through the winter to start it over again next year.
Okay, so I better be careful when I cut down around the plant. They don't go too far then? So I would be able to recognize the chrysalis?
Yeah, if you look on the internet, you'll see they're usually some forms of brownish, in fact, kind of mottled in color. Almost looks like they got 2 little horns up at the top end, kind of tapered. You can see the abdominal segments a little bit easier on, and maybe about 1 inch long or so, kind of cylindrical in shape.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Kathy. Appreciate it. Anne wonders if you could discourage people from using naphthalene. It may kill insects, but it makes the entire neighborhood a respiratory nightmare.
Well, you know, that's an old repellent for mosquitoes, and we also use it for carpet beetles and the like. And, you know, naphthalene is not good for people to breathe large quantities. And so, you know, I just don't find it a very efficient use of that product. In particular, and if there's that much naphthalene that you can smell it that easily, then as they said, I'm not so sure that's good for the people around them. So if people want to go that direction, there are definitely much better sprays that can be put out there that will work better than the naphthalene.
Jack in Neosho, your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I'm one of these rare and lucky people that can get bitten by literally hundreds of mosquitoes at once, and they're annoying to me, but I don't get any... I don't get anything on my skin from them. I don't get any itching or anything, so I can go out in any time of the day and work in my garden. And when you mentioned some research in Florida, I'd be interested in contacting them and see if I can help others with maybe there's something in my blood that they can synthesize and help other people. So Phil, can you give me the research on that or the reference?
Well, go to the University of Florida at Gainesville. Go to their entomology department and go under medical entomology, and that might be where you'd want to send the email to contact. As I said, I know there's also a USDA lab, but I think it's an association. It may even be within the department, so that would be the group that I would start. There's a gentleman by the name of Phil Kohler down there. He's one of the researchers, but he's definitely not the major researcher for that. But that's where I would start, University of Florida, Gainesville Entomology Department.
There
thanks
you go.
A lot.
Yep, thanks, Jack, for calling. Appreciate it. And we all hope that they can find something in you that would help the rest of us. Oh, man. Shirley and Prentice, your turn. Hi, Shirley.
Hello, Larry. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I've, for the last 2-3 summers, have found moth wings on the driver's side of my car, on the window, it's closed, and on the door. I think something's roosting up in the rafters during the night and brings his moths there, and... eats the bodies and drops the wings. I don't know what that... I'd like to know what that is.
Bats would be my first, you know, guess. Because I see this the same thing, some of these beautiful wild silkworm moths that are flying, and the bats just love to feed on them. And I've even been out, you know, boating, and you can find the wings floating in the water. So as I said, something feeding that way, that would be one choice. Mice will do that too, though, you know, but then it's a little bit more that the moths would have had to been resting or hiding in a place and the mice would get to it. So if it's been reoccurring, I wonder if bats are roosting up in the ceiling there.
I don't see bats around. I did have them once and I could see them flying out at night from the attic of the house, I guess. But these are rather small wings, smaller than my little fingernail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing is, and I don't know spider-wise, you know, because again, the wings aren't really anything you can digest much, and so they would feed on the main body. And I wonder if spiders are just pushing the undigestible stuff out of the webbing.
Could be.
Thanks, Shirley. Thanks a lot for calling. Betty in Neshota has a question. Am I killing the next generation of butterflies when I cut and remove dead plants in my butterfly garden each fall? I was told that only monarchs migrate and all the other butterflies overwinter in Wisconsin. They use garden plants, including vegetable plants, especially carrot tops. Is this true?
Well, again, it depends on the species of butterfly. There really, to me, is only about four or five butterflies that you can manipulate very easily with your plants, since so many of them are feeding on trees, shrubs, and other things that we're not associated with. So I wouldn't worry about that typically. You know, again, the monarchs, the chrysalises are usually very apparent, or they've already emerged by the time you're starting to clean up the garden that much. And I would think, as I said, even with the black swallowtails that are on the carrots and the parsnips and the like, they will migrate off and often get down in the litter. It's interesting, sometimes when people are tilling the soil, that's when I will get some of these, you know, moth pupae or butterfly pupae. And then it's best just to leave them, kind of undisturbed. You don't, just digging them up isn't so bad. Just put a little dirt on them and let them continue on their way type of thing. So, yeah, I don't think I would worry too much. It's always good to keep your eyes open, but I don't think you're really removing that much.
Al lives in the Madison area, and in the fall around his area, we have a very small bug that lands on the outside of our screens. They seem to start showing up in mid to late September and last until quite cold. Even after a significant frost, they may be alive. They're so small that when the windows are open to enjoy the beautiful fall air, they all blow through the screens and end up in the house.
Okay, my guess.
They're dark gray in color.
He has a hackberry tree because there's a little critter that we call a hackberry psyllid that causes these little wart-like growths on the leaves. And in the fall of the year, when it starts to drop leaves, these insects come out. And in the woods, they would overwinter underneath the bark scales. And, of course, hackberry's got that really stuckoy-like bark. There's a lot of places to crawl into. But when the trees are close to somebody's home, these little psyllids will line up on the windowsill and get through the screens and create quite a nuisance. And they do go a little bit hot and cold. Some years more than others, but boy, that'd be my first question. He's got to have a hackberry tree very close by, either on his property or his neighbors, and these insects are coming from the leaves.
Robert in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I have a problem with bed bugs. I live in a multi-unit building here in Milwaukee. Tell me what I can do, Phil.
Oh, boy.
I know. It's probably a program by itself.
Well, the thing about bed bugs is it's gotten in the realm that you need professional help. I mean, I really don't find most people, so let's just talk about some things to help. The mattress covers that they sell that are bed bug proof are a way of preventing them from being successful.
I have used that. I have that.
Okay.
I've used Pyrethrum.
Okay.
A product called Bedlam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, one of the things that we're finding because of some of this resistance problem is we're looking at more physical ways. And so there is forms of either diatomaceous earth. One is called Mother Earth Dust, but there's plenty of other formulations.
I've heard of that.
There's another product called silica aerogel, which is basically a synthetic version of diatomaceous earth. So like a very fine sand. And what these are used is to blow back into baseboard crevices or on the frame of the bed itself. Let's say if you had a metal bed with hollow posts, you know, where the bed bugs could get down in there. If you could pull the cap off, blow the dust in there and seal it up, what the dust does is it abrades the skin of the bed bugs and it kills them.
Okay.
And they can't become resistant to it. So it isn't the magic bullet, but in the right place it is very effective. So that is a product that a lot of the companies, and you can buy the product too. So you got to put it back into some of those hiding places. The sprays is where it gets more tricky. One of the things you might consider, well, a couple things. If you're in a rental situation, the normal landlord-tenant law, it's the landlord's responsibility. And no matter how the bedbugs got there, it's the landlord's responsibility. And here's the problem in multi-units is that when your neighbor gets them, if they don't do something quickly, you're going to get them. And so they will spread throughout almost like cockroaches. And so if a treatment is started, everybody's got to be involved. And so we even talk, not that every unit has to be treated, but every unit has to be inspected to see if indeed your neighbor's got them. Because if you don't, you just keep chasing them around and they'll never get taken care of.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. It's kind of an ongoing problem unless everybody really gets on a bandwagon, isn't it?
You know, and the other thing that's going on is that, you know, one of the more successful treatments are these heat treatments, but they're incredibly expensive. And we're talking $1,000 or more a unit. And so, we can see why the landlords are reluctant.
Sure.
But The one thing is, if that is done, they can't become resistant to it. So if it's done correctly, and it's not always done correctly, that's one of the things that make you nervous. You put all this money out and you think you solved the problem and you haven't. But the whole idea there is the bed bugs can't survive anything above 112 degrees. What they try to generate is 140 degrees ambient air temperature and cook them out. So
well, on a personal basis, in my unit, for instance, if I got a steam cleaner, would that help to do
yes.
this?
Steam cleaners, going along the mattress seam, going along other places, the limitation of steam is if the bed bug is hit by it, it's dead. But if it's in a wall or something, it's not going to get hot enough to get taken care of. So.
Yeah.
Freezing works on some items too. They don't do well at 0 degrees, but you can't freeze a bed type
right.
of thing. So it works for, small alarm clocks and those kind of
yeah.
things. Try to keep as much clutter out of the bedroom as possible, because anything that's there, they can find, get into,
yeah.
books, those kind of things. You get nervous when they really get bad. The more places they got to hide, the harder they are to take care of.
Okay.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. What type of bug would inflict 100-plus bites on my feet? This is from Christine. One evening, as I sat outside on a deck playing cards, I barely noticed that night, but had many red, itchy welts the next day. That was Saturday night, and they're still extremely itchy. Here we are Monday.
I get suspicious of chiggers. I get suspicious of mites. And chiggers are a type of mite. One of the most common mite problems that I get that cause bites is there's little parasitic mites associated with bird nests. And these little mites go crawling around. And, so if there's mm-hmm. a bird nest under a deck and all of a sudden the mites came out, you can pick up an awful lot of bites. I get the same thing, people sitting out on a couch or a hammock out on the front porch, and there's a bird nest right next to them. They don't think about it. And there, though, the bites typically get quite blistery.
Oh.
Whereas chiggers, it's usually more of a weepy type bite
yeah.
And the like. And the interesting thing for both of those is they cannot live off of us, and so we're kind of a dead end. That doesn't stop them from trying to taste us. And, of course, what happens anytime anything bites you, if it leaves a salivary component behind, your body can react to that, and that's what makes it itchy and the like. So I'd be real suspicious. As I said, it more is mite-related. I often think of fleas when we get a lot of bites around the ankles, but usually you both find those. They're big enough to see. They kind of itch when they bite. And you wouldn't get hundreds of bites. You usually get little clusters. And then there's usually a pet. I mean, we know
yeah.
the pet's got it. And so there's other pieces of evidence that would suggest it. So as I said, I wonder if you got into some chiggers or some bird mites.
Jeff in Onalaska, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, good afternoon. Good morning, I guess, gentlemen. I'd like to ask about some flies that appear to be in our yard. We've got a couple of walnut trees that are weeping a lot of sap. Falls on the patio table and the truck windows and everything else, and the flies tend to congregate there. They're the kind of the green iridescent ones. I'm just wondering if they're feeding on the sap.
Yeah, I bet you, because it's sugar water. I mean, and what I think you've got is either scales or aphids on the walnut, and when they feed, they excrete this excess sugar water, as we call honeydew, and that's what causes the stickiness on your truck windows and the like. And the other thing you'll see show up at this time of the year are yellow jackets. Because they're after the sugar water, too, just like they're after pop and stuff. And so there's a whole bunch of critters that are taking advantage of it. And, once the insects stop attacking the walnut tree, that should solve all the problems at once. It's just a question of when that will happen. And in the trouble with walnut trees is usually too big to spray, so that wouldn't be very practical. But it usually will go away relatively quickly. And the other thing with all these rains we would have, that should help to dissipate it somewhat, too, I would think.
All right. Bob in Sun Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm calling about elimination of anthills.
Yeah.
We have acquired quite a few recently, and we were told to use oatmeal, instant oatmeal, and we've tried that.
Didn't work.
It doesn't appear as if it's working. I don't know whether we've applied it properly.
No, I don't know of any research that would suggest oatmeal works.
Okay.
I'll be honest with you, treating ant nests organically is really difficult. I do know some people have had some success with boiling water, but it depends how big the nest is. And the secret to ants is that there's queens. And if the queen is killed, the nest is taken care of. But with these big ant nests, she can be 2 or 3 feet deep in the ground. And that's why I think it's so hard to kill them with hot water, because how do you get the water that deep? The one thing that I suggest to folks, and this, I really am more... using chemical treatments in this case, but
okay.
the hot water is if I've got a big nest, I take a metal rod or a dowel and I put three or four channels. I push that as far down in the ground to aid in the penetration deep in the ground to do any good. So if you want to pour hot water in there, it's fine. But I think there's hazards of carrying buckets of hot water around. So typically what I'll do is take a chemical that's registered for ants. The garden insecticide 7 or Carbaryl is a very common one, but there's many other ones that will work. I do the dowel trick. I mix the stuff up in a bucket of water, and I drench it on so it's soaking deep. That's it. To me, that's the whole secret with any strategy, is to get it deep enough to kill the queen. If I do that, then I'm done. If you're just treating the surface, I don't expect it to work.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling.
Another home remedy people used to talk about is you'd put things out there like a cornstarch. That was another one. It was supposed to solidify and cement in the ant's stomach. And, a lot of those home remedies, as I said, really have no scientific basis and don't work. Another one is that you'd mix anything that would react with the acid. They would blow up, and that doesn't work. And so, as I said, it's unfortunately, ants are really very quite successful. And they're really very beneficial. I mean, as long as they don't come in the kitchen or bite the children, I really don't get that concerned about them.
Dirk and Karen in Platteville have orange bugs with black markings all over their their milkweed plants.
It's called the milkweed seed bug. It reminds people of a box elder bug. And it's an interesting one because it's an insect that it kind of goes hot and cold. For a number of years, I never saw them, but in the last few years, they've been much more common. And the adults lay their eggs on the pods as they develop. The nymphal stage feeds on the seeds. So it doesn't hurt the plant per se, but it does cause some sterility in the milkweed seeds. And you get these clusters of, as they mentioned, orange abdomen, black-legged, black-headed bugs. But when they finally transform in the adult stage, they're more black and orange banded, would be a way of describing them.
And Jules in Sugar Creek, hi to you.
Sugar Camp, but Saturday I got bit by a mosquito, and I went to smack it, and it was huge, like a mosquito hawk, but it was biting me. And when I smacked it, a piece of its head stayed in my leg like a tick, and now I have a bruise there. What could that have been?
Well, the biggest, meanest-looking mosquito we have in here is called Serapha ciliata. It's a particular species. And it's about four times bigger than any mosquito people normally run into. And I've had a handful of people email me or whatnot about it. The bruise, hard to say what's going on there. I mean, that would not be a typical reaction. It's a bigger mosquito, so you might get a little bit of bigger bite out of it. But that's all I normally would expect from it.
Okay, there you go. July through August, Dwight and Judy have been fighting millipedes. How do you get them to surrender?
Well, again, this case we had talked earlier, the thing about it is trying to find out where they're coming from and head them off at the pass. And this may mean using one of these hose end attachments with a landscape insecticide or using a granular-based insecticide you can put on and put a swath 5 to 10 feet wide from where this long grass is or, I've seen them come out of no-till fields, those kind of things. So there's some source of organic matter they're marching. It may help to go out at night with a flashlight because that's when they're most active to see where they're marching from. But again, I think what most people think is they're breeding around the house. They spray their mulch and those kind of things, and it will kill what's there today, but more come crawling in tomorrow.
And guess what? We still have lots more to cover here, but Phil, we're out of time.
We'll be back.
Yeah, you'll be back in a month or so.
Sounds good.
All right, we'll do this all over again. Sorry we didn't get to everyone, but that's the way it works. When Phil's with us. Phil Pelletieri is a UW Extension entomologist. He works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus, and he'll be back in a month or so, and of course we'll talk with him again. We covered a lot of ground, though. He answered, that must almost be a record number of questions answered today.
Better than Dr. Craven, right?
They have a little competition going, Scott and Phil. Well, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with us tomorrow to talk about your pet's health. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.